I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Members, we have two bills on the agenda today, and before we get to that, we're going to approve last meeting's minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 17th, 2020?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn moves approval of the minutes for January 17th, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 17, 2023 are approved. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 25. This is the Representative Frazier bill. He'll be up there a lot today because both bills on the agenda today are his. And Representative Frazier, I believe your motion is that House File 25 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That is correct, Chair.
All right, so your bill is before us, and I also see that you have an amendment, and that is the A5 amendment, is that correct?
That is correct, Chair.
All right, would you please, I know you've moved the A5 amendment, and I assume that's to put the bill in the shape you desire.
That is correct, Chair.
Please go ahead and describe your amendment.
The amendment, after meeting with Superintendent Evans, it clarifies the intent of the resources that were provided to BCA and how those resources should be used, just to get the bill in the shape of the original intent. That's the motion.
Thank you. And I do see that there is an amendment to the amendment, and I believe that's the A6. And Representative Novotny, is that your amendment?
Yes, it is, Chair.
All right. So Representative Novotny moves the A6 before the committee. Would you please describe what your amendment to the amendment does?
My amendment is a very simple two-word amendment. And in front of the words, in front of the funding for $15 million to the BCA, Violent Crime Reduction Clearance and Support, I simply have this amendment to remove the words up to. I feel that if we're going to commit to this level of funding, they need to know exactly what is going to be available and not have it subject to withdrawal for other reasons. So for that, I ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny brought this up at a community meeting that we were at together. So I was there. I don't know if you knew I was in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
I think you did know I was in the audience. But thought about this. I think this makes sense. The intent is to provide that amount to BCA. So there is no issues with accepting this amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion on the A6 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A6 amendment is adopted. All right, now we will discuss the A5 amendment as amended. Discussion to the A5. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A5 amendment as amended is adopted. Members, we are going to delay discussion of the other amendments. I think we have three other amendments. We'll delay discussion of those amendments until after we hear from the testifiers. So just know that that's on my radar, but we're gonna go ahead and move now to a discussion of the bill and the testifiers. Representative Frazier, would you like to tell us about your bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I will be brief because we do have important voices here to speak to provide a perspective on the bill. Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, Lead, and committee members. Last year, I introduced the Public Safety Innovation Package. That bill was drafted after many conversations with community members, law enforcement groups, and conducted research on proven crime prevention, intervention, and reduction strategies. That bill proposed a multi-pronged approach for reduction, intervention, and prevention of crime, a data-driven approach that sought to target and provide resources to where they are needed most. By providing funding to local and tribal governments and community organizations that provide services that are proven to aid in reducing crime, and also provide funding to law enforcement for proven necessary tools to deter, investigate, and solve crimes. Today I offer House File 25, which seeks to provide funding for the innovative multifaceted approach as proposed in the Public Safety Innovation Package. Accordingly, House File 25 will establish a Community Crime and Prevention Fund to provide resources for local governments and tribal governments to provide crime prevention and intervention strategies based on what works for their communities. In addition, House File 25 establishes the Violent Crime Reduction and Clearance Support Fund. This fund will provide resources to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, also known as BCA, BCA will be able to allocate these funds to local units of government facing the most acute need based on the rate of violent crime and need for help to improve crime clearance rates. House File 25 also establishes a Crisis Response and Criminal Investigation Fund. This fund will be administered by the Office of Justice Programs and will award grants to local law enforcement agencies and local governments to improve responses to mental health crises and criminal investigations. Lastly, House File 25 will provide funding to continue the BCA's independent use of force investigation unit, which, among other areas, provides investigations when a law enforcement officer uses force and a person dies or is seriously injured, as well as investigations of sexual assault allegations involving Minnesota Peace officers. Madam Chair, I have several testifiers here today to share their perspectives on this bill. I will yield for testimony.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Our first testifier is Andrew Martin Bentley. If you could please come down to the committee table. Go ahead and introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony. And then just so that members know, the next person on deck is LaTanya Black.
My name is Andrew Bentley, and I'd like to thank this committee for the opportunity to speak today. I work for the Harvard Kennedy School Government Performance Lab on the Criminal Justice Policy Team. My team works with city governments, including the Carter administration here in St. Paul, on community safety policy implementation. But I'm not representing my organization today. I'm here as a resident of South Minneapolis. Originally, though, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in Madison, Wisconsin. Back then, my mother was struggling with mental health issues that resulted in fits of long-lasting rage and disorientation. She also had multiple sclerosis, a neurological disease that caused both cognitive and physical decline in her. Back then, my mother was dependent on a cane. In the middle of a sunny summer day back then in the early 90s, during one of her outbursts of rage and disorientation, she called 911. Two armed police officers arrived and questioned each family member separately. When it was discovered my mother had hit my dad on his leg with her cane during her outburst, even though it wasn't hard and didn't hurt, the officers took action. They were obligated to arrest my mother due to domestic violence laws. There was nothing they could do, they said. The officers didn't discuss my mother's mental or physical health with us. She was never referred to services in the community. I stood on my lawn and watched my sick mother, who was less than 5 feet tall, get arrested. As my mother walked down the driveway, I saw helplessness and shame in her face. That moment caused my mother to develop resentment that festered for decades. She resented the police for their obligation and my father for not preventing the arrest. And when she found out, remember, I was just a little boy, that I was the one who told the officers she had hit my father, she resented me. Those struggles became more intense, and she never did get the support she needed, and she passed away 4 years ago. My father, the kindest man I know, became my mother's caretaker for 30 years. But back on that day, I stood on my lawn and watched him weep and beg the officers not to arrest his sick wife. Take me, he pleaded. He felt he had failed as her caretaker. I don't remember the names of the officers, but I imagine they also felt helplessness in their obligation and their lack of training. They weren't mental health experts or social workers, and they hadn't been informed where to refer this sick woman. There's nothing we can do, they said. After my mother called for help, helplessness is what connected us all. That day could have been an inflection point in the other direction. I truly believe that. If the people who had answered that call could have identified that she was struggling with mental health, they could have connected her with services that prevented her suffering. Instead of being obligated by law, how are we obligated by humanity, and how are we supporting those who need the most? House File 25 is our opportunity to change who answers the call here in Minnesota. An entire system has to be rebuilt. Support to hire social workers, train them, overhaul our 911 triage process, and develop mental health and community safety services across the state. These efforts are happening all across the country. I know because I've talked to the mayors. We're part of a movement, but in order for Minnesota to lead, we need to be bold and commit to building a world that can better answer the call for your mother, your daughter, your brother, or you. To honor my mother, I urge the support of House File 25.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I'm sure your mother would be proud of you for your testimony today. Thank you. Next up, we have LaTanya Black, and on deck, we have Mary Moriarty. Welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself for the record, and then you can begin your testimony.
My name is LaTanya Black, and thank you, Chair Moeller, for having me here, and I am supportive of House File 25. I'm a native of Minnesota. I grew up in South Minneapolis, about four blocks from Minnehaha Falls. I am a Roosevelt Teddy, woohoo Teddies. And on May 5th of 1997, I gave birth to a beautiful, bouncing, healthy baby girl, Nia Amadi Black. And on June 13th of 2020, exactly 9.1 miles from Fairview Riverside Hospital where she was born, exactly 3.1 miles from where we sit today, Nia was shot and murdered. She was shot in the head at 23 years old, right up the street from here, and my baby died instantly on the scene. My life has forever changed. My family and I are not the same. I was watching a movie of Mamie Till not too long ago when she was discussing her son Emmett. And although it's been 67 years, what she said in that movie resonated in my soul. She said when Emmett was taken, it felt like arrows were being shot all over her body. I know that emotion. She said her eyes were welled up with tears that she couldn't even see. I know that emotion. And I would take it a step further to say, I know what it's like to, Nia was about 6 years old. She broke her arm. She came running in the house. Oh, mommy, look at my arm. And there's this bone sticking up. And I was freaking out. But she was so calm. And in that moment, I could take her to the hospital because they were able to give her a cast. They could fix that. If you have a headache, you can take Tylenol. If you have body aches, you can take ibuprofen. But there is absolutely nothing for the pain of a heartbreak. There's nothing you could take. If you think about your child coming in, I don't know if you're a parent, but if your child scrapes herself, you can bandage, put a Band-Aid on, kiss it, make it better. You could take your child to the hospital to be cared for. But I wasn't there the night that Nia died. She was just a passenger in a car. Nia was a full-time college student. She was an educator. She was a business owner of 2 years. She taught entrepreneurship in the local college. Nia was an exceptional young lady. And because of that, this is why I do what I do. When a child is murdered, you get the call, but you don't get to see your child. It took me about a week for them to actually allow me to see Nia. And when I did go to the funeral home, they told me that her body is here. You can come and view your child. You have to remember, Nia left my house healthy, looking good, and smelling good. And she never came home. And I say smelling good because she used to order this certain perfume online. And I'd always remember that smell. And I remember when I stood over her. And Mamie Till also said that when she looked down at her son, he was brutally beat. She looked at the hole in his head, and she could see through it. And she could see daylight. When I stood over Nia, I seen the wound in the back of her head. And I was able to touch it, and I was able to feel it. And I told her I was not going to rest until we found out who did this to her. And I would advocate to the ends of the world for my child, as I believe each and every one of you would. So I sit here today as the mother of a gun violence victim, and I am the founder of Mothers Against Community Gun Violence. 21 days after Nia was murdered, I birthed Mothers Against Community Gun Violence in this world, and we have been going nonstop since then. So I just want you to know that, again, I am in support of House File 25 because it would allow my gun violence prevention organization and other organizations to have a greater reach for victims, families, and survivors living with the traumatic, traumatizing everyday life sentence of living with someone affected by gun violence or their life has been taken. At MAGGV, we seen the need and we fed the need. There was the frontline crisis work, but who was helping these families? Healing and restoration was needed. Mothers were crying out. So at my organization, we offer healing and restoration services, mental health services. We, regardless of your zip code, regardless, Nia was murdered by community gun violence. But if it is suicide, if we advocate for that, if it is mass shootings, school shootings, across statewide Minnesota, we are here because gun violence has to stop. Again, regardless of your zip code or what you look like, parents are hurting, and we have to help our people. And we also want you to know that before I leave, I'm asked the question, how do you tell her story? You've told it over and over. How do you continue to do that? I do it because I made a promise to my baby, and I'm an extension of Nia, and I have never said his name in public. But I will say it today because it's fitting. James Jones Fields, the murder of my daughters, does not get to write her story. I am the narrator of Nia's story. I am the author of her story. And I will continue to write the love, life, and legacy of Nia Black until I have no breath. I thank you, Chair, for having me today.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for the important work you do. And members, I would encourage you to look at MACTV's website, and I'm sure that Ms. Black and other members of that organization would be glad to talk with you further about the work they're doing in community. The next testifier is Mary Moriarty, and on deck we have Superintendent Evans. Welcome to the committee, and if you can go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Moeller and members of the committee, thank you so very much for allowing me this opportunity to talk to you. I am Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty, testifying on behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in support of House File 25, the Public Safety Innovation Package. As a county attorney, my primary responsibility is to protect the safety and the rights of those who visit or reside in Hennepin County. As the newly elected prosecutor for the largest county in the state, one of the most populous counties in the nation, I know this is an historic moment in time. The murder of George Floyd and the pandemic forced our public safety systems to begin an unprecedented transformation. The sizable but short-lived infusion of American Rescue Plan dollars enabled us to invest in new ways to deliver public safety. This is my third week in office, and I have met with law enforcement from Hennepin County Suburban Police. I have met with Chief O'Hara and members of his staff, and also law enforcement from the state. We all recognize the need for smart, sizable, and sustainable investments in emerging best practices so that we can effectively respond to the challenges our communities face. This visionary bill meets this historic moment. I support targeted investments for our law enforcement partners. Resources to help them increase clearance rates will help our office hold people accountable and increase public safety. Specifically, the investments into forensic analysts at the BCA will help us expedite our ability to secure justice for sexual assault survivors. The most innovative and visionary aspect of this legislation is the Community Crime and Violence Prevention Grants. The criminal legal system's traditional focus has been on the period of time after the crime until some kind of resolution of the case. This bill represents an historic recognition that investing in prevention and intervention will help prevent harm and save lives. These grants will fund victim services, reentry programs, restorative justice, juvenile diversion programs, and many other types of interventions which are essential to ensure we protect all Minnesotans. In closing, all Minnesotans deserve to be safe in their communities, no matter where we live or what we look like. I am proud to support House File 25 because it presents an historic opportunity to achieve public safety for all. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Superintendent Drew Evans. Welcome back to the committee, Superintendent. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for having me here today and members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We appreciate Representative Frazier's bill in addressing, as County Attorney Moriarty noted, the resources that are needed to continue ongoing work that is being done currently. Currently, the BCA, for the first part of the bill, the money that would be in the amendment that would be directed to the BCA, we have a team of agents that's working with Minneapolis, surrounding areas, addressing some of these emerging violent crime needs that we are seeing. And there has been an increase. This committee has examined some of that in past years, and we continue to see elevated levels of violence in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and a greater area. That team is working very closely with local partners, our federal partners, and other state partners to address some of these needs, and that team has seen some results. We've seen that crime has gone down when we have exactly what County Attorney Moriarty noted, really targeted, strategic, smart approaches to policing. But currently it's not sustainable. And what this bill would do would allow us to sustain those efforts, both for the work that we're doing, but then expand it with our local partners who we've heard over and over are willing to step up and join teams. But because of the resource challenges they are experiencing in their communities, they need additional funding so that they can join teams to do this work. Just as a note for the work that just our team has been doing with all of those partners together, just since April, we've arrested 652 individuals and seized over 350 firearms during that time period. And these are all focused on violent crime. And so the need is there, and the need will continue to move on. And we also want to look at different things to enhance this work. If this funding were provided here, we would take the approach that County Attorney Moriarty just noted. It would be strategic, using criminal intelligence analysts to really understand the crime, assist our police officers and agents that are out doing this work day in, day out. It would address forensics to more quickly analyze evidence as it comes into our laboratories to provide answers to our police officers out doing the day-to-day work on these cases. And lastly, we'd be able to form a team that would continue on, that would be really taking that approach of looking at the most violent crime as it's occurring in our communities. The framework is in place, and the money, as you have outlined here with Representative Frazier's bill, could certainly be enacted in a way that's very similar to a bill that was introduced last year in a violent crime reduction support initiative, and happy to provide members any additional information on that as we contemplate it. We look forward to continued discussions on this as the governor continues to roll out his budget requests and recommendations to the legislature, and look forward to the ongoing discussion. I want to just quickly note the Force Investigations Unit. We greatly appreciate the ongoing funding identified in this bill for that team. That team has been in place and has been fully operational, and this funding would allow that team to continue at its current rate from what we are currently doing. It doesn't expand it any way. It would keep the operations going. As you know, it sunsets. And that team has been really instrumental for us, both for the workload that we've seen increasing in terms of investigating these cases to ensure they're very thorough, done in a transparent manner that people can trust in the investigative process and the public, and then secondly, due to the additional cases that we've seen. In just this past year, as an indication for you, we did 15 deadly force investigations. That's slightly down, but it's right in the slot for where we normally see those number of cases is 15 to 25 and remains remarkably similar over the years. We've done 25 sexual assault investigations, or accusations of criminal sexual conduct involving peace officers that are required under the statute and will allow us to continue that work. 8 sexual assault investigations involving Minnesota National Guard members and Minnesota National Guard victim survivors in those cases, and then 12 conflict investigations where a peace officer or public official was accused of some sort of misconduct in that case. So the funding is greatly appreciated and will allow us to continue that independent, unbiased approach to those cases. And that is my testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent. And I do believe we have several members of the public who have signed up to testify on this bill. We are going to limit your testimony to, a minute and a half. The first testifier is Chair Irene Fernando, and on deck we have Antonio Williams. So welcome to the committee, Chair. If you could state your name for the record, and please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Mohler and members. My name is Irene Fernando, Hennepin County Board Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to testify about the need for this important violence prevention and crisis response funding. And thank you to the resident testifiers for your very, very compelling and heartfelt testimony. My colleague, Commissioner Lundy, wanted to testify as chair of the Public Safety Committee, but was actually scheduled to launch our 911 mental health response pilot with North Memorial, which is very fitting because today I would like to focus my minute and a half on expanding embedded social workers, and this is the perfect funding source. There continues to be a critical need for an integrated approach of public safety and behavioral health working together to support residents facing mental health-related challenges. This is an important step to improve the response we give to people. The collaboration between public safety and behavioral health built capacity within the emergency response system to better manage mental health-related calls. When people call 911 for a public safety need, fire, or medical emergency, a specially trained person arrives. This is not the case when people call 911 for a mental health need. This mismatch in training, response, and need are costly to both residents and the system at large. The result puts people on a path of repeated traumatic exposure, overuse of inappropriate interventions, and poor health outcomes. The county funds mental health training and support for our 911 dispatchers and mental health professionals at dispatch locations throughout the county. We passed a resolution that authorized to expand this program and anticipate a total of 34 social workers embedded countywide in 29 police departments in 42 cities. This is a very, very necessary step to ensuring the compassion and results-oriented work that we need for our residents, and we seek to be in partnership with you. Thank you for your the time.
Thank you so much. Our next testifier is Antonio Williams, and then on deck we have Jeff Potts. And Mr. Williams, welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony. And then we are, as you heard, the timer's going off, so sorry about that, but we will hold up a sign when there's 30 seconds left.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Antonio Williams. I am founder of Tone Up, Teaching Ourselves New Examples to Uplift People. I am in support of House File 25 because I understand that we must shift our definition of what it means to prevent violence, to address the need to combat the violence and the harm in our communities. We must start relying on the people who are survivors of these harms and of these systems that have given harm to our communities. There are organizations such as Until We Are All Free, the Power of People Leadership Institute, and my organization, as well as Mothers Against Community Gun Violence, who are out here doing groundbreaking work, work that our system has failed to do. Just last year, a report came out that said 60% of all new intakes into the Department of Corrections were due to supervision failures. To me, that says that our system is failing. Our system doesn't have the resources to take on the burden of overcrime, overharm that is in our communities. And so what we need to do is look at this bill as a partnership, as a way to lean on our communities, our survivors, our experts, because they have went through the things that a lot of the community hasn't. And so we hold an expertise that a lot of the community doesn't. This bill says that we are relying and we are partnering with people who understand on an intimate level of what it takes to restore dignity, to prevent harm, to prevent crime, and to be a productive member of society and have hope restored. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Jeff Potts is up next, and on deck we have Lori Weissman. Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Potts, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Chiefs Association, which is over 300 police chiefs and command staff members around the state, as well as the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, the 87 elected sheriffs. My comments today, Madam Chair, I'll keep them brief. We much appreciate Representative Frazier's efforts here to address some very serious problems that we are seeing throughout our state. We support the framework. Section 2, as we've heard from Superintendent Evans, about $15 million to support these investigative violent crime investigative teams, about $30 million for the community crime and violence prevention grant program, which I think is an excellent opportunity to build partnerships to address some of these in a more preventative mode. The $25 million in Section 6 is important as we look at alternative ways to respond to situations involving people who are in a mental health crisis. I just want to give a little bit of comment on kind of the amounts within there. We do feel very strongly that the model and framework that has been put together by the BCA and their partners to address violent crime is working. We would urge the committee to consider increasing that $15 million. We think that can have a very quick and immediate results and hopefully preventing situations like we heard about earlier here today with gun violence affecting individuals, young individuals in our community. Very much appreciate the comments by the mother and her courage to testify here today, but we think those investigative units can be very helpful in preventing and changing that. One last thing for the record, it takes a long time to put together alternative response models. Embedded social workers, I have experience with that in my time in Bloomington. It can take a year to put that program together. This money sunsets in about 14 or 15 months. We urge the committee to consider adding that to the base. We think those are very valuable programs that take a while to put together and wish that you would consider that as ongoing funding. Thank you. I appreciate your time. I apologize for going over.
Thank you, Mr. Potts. And we will have other bills before this committee, too, that address funding and all of those things, too. This is our first step.
Thank you, sir.
Next up, we have Lori Weissman. And on deck, we have Ramesha Jones. Please come up to the testifier table, introduce yourself, and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Frazier and the committee for hearing me testify today. My name is Lori Weissman, and I have been a gun safety advocate for the past 20 years with numerous organizations in the Twin Cities, including Mothers Against Community Gun Violence, the testimony from today of the wonderful LaTanya Black, Protect Minnesota, Moms Demand Action, National Council of Jewish Women, Minnesota, and numerous others. I am before you today to voice my strong support for House File 25, particularly as relates to the provision of grants for community violence and intervention and prevention services. Through my work over the last 2 years, in particular with LaTanya Black and MACGV, I have personally witnessed and taken part in the education and essential healing programs provided by that organization. I have seen how these services are delivered and witnessed positive outcomes for victims who participate. It even has had an impact on me personally after all of the work I've done over the past 20 years in gun violence prevention, which is itself its own form of trauma, if you will. It is critical that the work that MACGV and similar organizations like them survive and remain sustainable, which of course requires the funding that this bill offers. Please pass this bill to promote the community healing that is essential to public safety. I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Next up is Ramesha Jones. There you are, I couldn't see you behind the chairs here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mola, for having me here today, and I am in support of House File 25. Hello, all. I'm Ramesha Jones. I'm a victim of community gun violence. I'm an advocate of Mothers Against Community Gun Violence, who lost her son at 15 years old, April the 12th, 2021. Imagine getting a text or just a phone call, your child been shot or killed, the day of Dante Wright. Hanging with the wrong kids, my child was 15, ambitious football star. He went to Roseville Area Middle High School, Falcon Heights Elementary School. My son had never been in a fight, never been suspended. But when COVID came, he got hooked up with the wrong friends. 9 months changed my son's life. I live in St. Paul. My son got murdered in Minneapolis. The help that the county offers wasn't right for me. I didn't feel safe. I was broken. You have shame and you have guilt. I was misunderstood. until I was introduced to Mothers Against Community Gun Violence, where I found love, understanding, people who could identify with my hurt, my pain, and my suffering. The services of restorative yoga, my weekly group meetings with other grieving moms who lost a child. It's so different from people who have lost a mother, a father, or a sibling. But imagine losing a child. The help specialist to help us eat right, think clearly, to understand and comprehend where do I go from here. The county doesn't give us a blueprint for that. How do I pick up the pieces of everyone judging me? It's your fault, this and that, living with shame when you have two other kids looking at you. If I'm broken and hurt, what do I have to offer my two kids? The county couldn't give me that. So without MAG GV, I could not be able to stand here before you today. Today, I can step out of my shame and step into my new norm of healing because it's a daily life struggle. And I want to say thank you again, Mola, for having me. But just imagine getting a text and not having a blueprint of where to go from there. And that's my story.
Thank you so much for sharing your testimony with us today, and we really do appreciate you being here.
Thank you, guys.
We don't have any other members of the public signed up to testify. Is there any other public testimony? Oh, please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony.
Greetings. My name is Thomas Evenstad, E-V-E-N-S-T-A-D. And I want to say hello to Chair and greet you, members of the committee. The reason that I'm testifying today is to help save lives. I'm testifying in support of this bill, and I am respectfully asking the committee to consider an amendment for once the most violent and dangerous criminals have been identified with the funding that goes to the law enforcement agencies. I'm advocating in the strongest possible measure to prevent more stories like we've heard that are preventable and they're unfortunately all too predictable. So what I'm talking about is the Department of Corrections that I spent a decade in has violence recidivism scoring on every single person that is in our prison system. So just like the sex criminals are subject to lifetime incapacitation via civil commitment, you bypass the criminal system. So you don't have problems with perhaps prosecutors or judges that are going the wrong direction. So I'm here to advocate for more rights for innocent people and less rights for the most violent and dangerous criminals. So once they've been identified by the DOC, set up an MSOP, Minnesota Violent Offender Program. Only have it be a real treatment program where MSOP is 85% white. And I'll just finish with this comment. MSOP is 85% white. Why is there not a state program for behavioral and violence intervention for our juveniles and our youth, particularly people of color, so that they can get treatment, violence treatment, before they're released into society again? Thank you very kindly for all your help.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to move on now to a discussion of the amendments and the bill. First, I believe that the A1 amendment is withdrawn because of our adoption of the A6. I'm seeing Representative Novotny give me a thumbs up. So next we have the A2 amendment. Who will be offering the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, that would be me.
Representative Mueller, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this amendment is what we are doing here is we are actually, I'm trying to get both copies of everything going on here, is on in the grant recipient program, if we are looking in line, let's see, 3.9, 3.10, 3.11, what we are doing is that we're tightening up some of the language in this amendment. We would ask that we would delete the words including but not limited to for the community crime and violent prevention grant eligibility and replaces it with a more transparent and more accountable language that just says these are eligible for the grants. And so nothing is changing the amount of money. Nothing is changing about who is eligible for the grants. We just are concerned about the words that says may include but are not limited to. The amendment, this amendment is important because since we are spending quite a bit of money on these grants, rightfully so, for several of them, we want to make sure that since these tax dollars are going to these in large amounts to these as grants to these organizations, that we need to ensure there is no waste or fraud or abuse, that we have as much transparency as possible. We have learned from our past mistakes of Feeding Our Future scandal that whenever there's a large portion of money that is available, that there is a possibility for misuse of taxpayer funds. So I would really like there to be a change in words that would be more specific so that we are able to limit the possibility of abuse and fraud and change these words to that these are that let's see that we are changing these words to these are eligible for grants under this section instead of are included but not limited to. Thank you.
Representative Frazier to the A2.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller. I appreciate and understand what you're getting at. That transparency piece is important. That's why there is a reporting requirement in this bill that will be run through OJP. And the reason, so that's the one piece, the transparency piece, we'll have that there, and those reports will be provided to the legislator for our review so that we can have more conversation if necessary. But we'll know exactly where things are going. Those will also be public under our Data Privacy Act. So Minnesotans will know where the money is going as well and how it's being spent. The other piece around removing the but limited to, part of the reason I call it innovation is because I want local communities to be able to decide what it is that works best for their communities. And what I don't want to do is put any shackles on them so that prevents them from doing that. I'm not in every community. I tell you, I had the privilege of going around the state during the campaign season, so I got to talk to a lot of folks, but I haven't been in every community. So I don't know in every community what works best for them. But those local leaders and those community members, they do know what works best for them, and I don't want to shackle them. So I would say I'd like to keep that language there, so I would respectfully decline to accept your amendment.
A further discussion to the A2. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I'll just point out, you know, for the record, if you go to lines 3.9 and 3.10, programs must identify specific outcomes that can be tracked and measured to demonstrate the impact the program has on community crime and violence. So just some random nonprofit wouldn't be able to qualify. It has to be a program that meets these specific criteria. And then as Representative Frazier noted, they must report then on those specific outcomes that are outlined in 3.9. Thanks.
Further discussion? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for explaining some of the accountability measures that are already there. What I'm concerned about is that, especially with some of the scandals that we've already seen, they already did meet those requirements. And so I just want to make sure that I know we want to be innovative and all those things, but we need to make sure that we are being very specific with how this taxpayer money is being spent. And so as much as it's possible for us to bring as much transparency as possible and bring as much accountability as possible, we need to remove the language that says, but not limited to. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
Chair Mueller?
No.
Vice Chair Feist?
Yeah.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative Becker-Finn?
No.
Representative Dugan?
Yes.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Grussell?
Yes.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Kapke?
No.
Representative Whitty?
Yes.
With 6 ayes and 8 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 6 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail and Amendment A2 is not adopted. The next amendment is the A3 amendment. Whose amendment is that?
That would be mine, Chair.
Representative Novotny to the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. We're just looking to strike one of the provisions that where the grants can be used for line 3.15 homelessness assistance programs. It's frustrating at this point because when we ask how much money is spent on homelessness right now, that is an unknown number, and it's just a guess based on the multiple funding sources going towards homelessness right now. There's already countless programs and things that are spent right now that we can look at. It's a laundry list of things that we can, different organizations dedicated to homelessness. Just the wording of the bill, homelessness assistance programs. I'm on human services policy. We spend a lot of money on assisting homelessness as it is. If there was a public safety based program, it'd be homelessness reduction or elimination, but all we're doing right now, it seems, I've been coming to the Capitol for 3 years, I haven't seen any reduction in homelessness. I don't think that this program, the grants in this section are set up for public safety, not human services assistance. It doesn't fit the grant. We're here for crime prevention and victim services and things like that. I just don't think it fits what this committee and what our funding stream for this committee are for. With that, I ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, I understand what you're getting at about other programs providing resources, but I can guarantee you, I've looked at the data, I've talked to experts, that when you assist someone that is unsheltered and providing them with stable shelter, it absolutely has an impact on public safety. For one, you're vulnerable when you're unsheltered, so you're probably preventing them from being harmed or being put in a position to be a victim. Also, we know that folks that are homeless, they are in need. They're looking for things, which may lead to those individuals getting caught up and possibly committing harm to the community. That is the reason it's there. There's absolutely intersectionality, and there's absolutely data to back up the fact that if you can provide stable shelter for folks, it does have an impact on public safety. So I would urge a no on Representative Botany's amendment, but I do appreciate what you're saying.
Discussion on the amendment. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And to go off of what Representative Frazier just said, I mean, you could also read it to say homelessness assistance programs that identify specific outcomes that can be tracked and measured to demonstrate the impact the program has on community crime and violence. So it isn't just any random homelessness assistance program. It is homelessness assistance programs that can identify specific outcomes that are tied to community crime and violence. We also know that folks who have been incarcerated, folks who have recently left either the jail or the prison system, have a harder time accessing housing. So it very much is in line as we look at recidivism rates and we try to stop those recidivism from happening. This absolutely is in line, I think, with the overall goals. Further, I mean, the cruelty that has been leveraged both historically and currently against our community members who are unhoused. This is a way to address some of those problems that are longstanding problems and absolutely belongs in this bill because all these things are interconnected. None of our systems exist as standalone programs. And so, again, we just encourage folks to look at the whole bill, read all of the language within Subdivision C, and I think it very much is in line with the overall goals here. So thank you, Representative Frazier.
Further discussion to the A3. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. I'm at a loss for the words where anything that I said or advocated for here falls into the cruelty statute, but I think we have programs that are set up to assist homelessness. If we need to increase that funding or come up with a different program through the departments that are supposed to handle that, I think we should. With that, I ask for a roll call vote.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll on the A3 amendment.
Chair Moeller?
No.
Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative Becker Finn?
No.
Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Representative Fraser?
No.
Representative Grussel?
Yes.
Representative Holland?
No.
Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Tapke?
No.
Representative Witte?
Yes.
With 6 ayes and 8 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 6 ayes and 8 nays, the A3 amendment is not adopted. All right, I think we have one more amendment, the A4. Who would like to offer the A4? Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this up. I think we heard a lot of really compelling testimony today, and we heard from a lot of groups that really are engaging with communities and making sure that violence prevention grants and all of those resources that we're bringing to the table are actually utilized. And my amendment, as it stands, what it will do is it actually allows more of those dollars to go towards what we called in the NGO sector shovel-ready programs. These guys are shovel-ready. They're tackling the violence that we're starting to see in communities all across the state of Minnesota, not just in the Twin Cities area. It really is a holistic approach to public safety. And I'd like to see more of those dollars actually utilized into those forms of grants. So this would actually amend the 2.5% of the $205 million, which would equate to around $5 million that would go towards the Office of Justice programs that they're allowed to withhold. And this would limit it to around $2 million, which I believe is more than adequate. So that's my amendment, and I hope that members support it.
Thank you. Representative Frazier to this amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we do have staff from OJP here, but what I'll say to that, just initially what I'll say, and OJP can speak to the resource that they need, is the reason those resources are there, it would be, you know, up to, they don't have to use that total 2.5, and these are finite resources. They're going to last for about 5 years, hoping to get them in the base to be permanent, because I think you're right. There are organizations out there that are doing the work, and they need to be sustained to do this work long-term to keep our communities safe. But that 2.5 doesn't mean that they're going to hold that 2.5% back. In fact, what they don't hold back, they will put directly into the program. But I wanted to give them the resources necessary so they can adequately get these resources out to the communities and out to the local government so that they can provide resources to keep our communities safe.
All right. Ms. Weeks, would you like to come to the committee? Please introduce yourself. And I will just note, too, as you're walking to the table, that 2.5% is standard language. It's not in statute, but it's a pretty standard number that's used for administrative costs. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about how we would use that 2.5%. As Chair Mueller stated, that is standard language with OJP grants in the state of Minnesota. And what we use that money for is administration of the grant. So that funds all of the staff required to meet all of the grant management requirements that the state has put out. So the Office of Grant Management in the Department of Administration has a whole set of obligations that the Department of Public Safety is responsible for in administering the grants, and we need staff to do that. And so currently we have grant managers on staff, we have finance and compliance people on staff, we have contract managers on staff. And what we do with that staff is really work, so not only that goes at the beginning of the RFP process, so as people apply for the grants, we go through a review process of the grants, and then those that are selected to receive the grants, we work with them on setting up project management, budget, they're subject to financial audits, they have to put together a bunch of documents for us to make sure that they are qualified to receive and manage the grants. From that point, our grant managers work very, very closely with all of our grantees to make sure that funds are being used for what their purpose is for. And so we're there supporting them. And what we do is that we have a reimbursement process with the state of Minnesota. And so after a nonprofit spends the money, then they seek reimbursement. And so we make sure all of those financial documents that are required for that reimbursement are met. And so we also have desk reviews, financial reviews, site visits, and monitoring reporting requirements. And so that money is absolutely critical. That 2.5% goes directly into making sure that that money is being used for the purposes it's meant for, and to make sure that our grantees are successful in meeting the intention of that money. And so although 2.5% may seem like a lot, that is multiple staff throughout that process. So it's grant managers, finance, compliance, grants, contracts, and the like.
Okay, further discussion to the amendment. Representative Pinto, did you have something you wanted to say?
Just quickly, that I know we've got concerns about tracking this money and how it's being spent, et cetera, and it takes money to do that. And I'm working with OJP, they do incredible work in that area. So. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank everyone for coming in and have the courage today to share this and bring this to light. This piece was very helpful to hear about the grant process, because looking at it, I was a little concerned, and I want to make sure that we're doing the best to help the victims. So my only question would be, handling this, or done it in the past, there's a program that you have to send back a report. Is that possible to bring it back to the committee so we can see the good work that's being done and see that our money is going in the right direction? Because I think that helps too. That's the transparency here. We're all making votes today to support this. And I think at the end, I think law enforcement needs the help, but it's also we need to hear the stories back, because today was very compelling to hear these people talk. And I think in the afterwards. So I just bring that up as a, you helped me by understanding the process. Thank you. Thank you.
Any follow-up? No. Okay. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, and for your testimony and kind of addressing some of those grant oversight and administrative things that maybe might go unnoticed if we don't ask these questions. Just a follow-up question, is 2.5% the average cost of the O&M and administrative side of things when it comes to these grants?
Ms. Weeks.
Chair Mueller, that is a great question, Representative. Actually, 2.5% for OJP is actually less than the norm. There are other agencies that receive 5%, and federal funds allow for up to 10%.
Representative Ingen.
I'll just reiterate the question. Is that the average cost, 2.5% for OJP?
Ms. Weeks.
Chair Mueller, members, that is the amount that was set by legislature that is contained in rider language with our appropriations.
Representative Ingen.
I'll just ask one more time, yes or no, is that the average cost, 2.5%?
Do you have closing comments on the amendment, Representative Ingen?
I would just urge support on this.
Thank you. All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. All right, members, we'll move on to a discussion of the bill as amended. I will note that we have many testifiers signed up for the next bill as well, so we're going to try to keep this moving. Do we have Representative Hewitt?
Just a quick question. I think one of our police officers in the room, either the chief, our former Bloomington chief, or Bill Hutton, whichever one wants to come up, I just have to ask you quickly about the social worker program. Again, in my last term, I was pretty much opposed to this, but now I'm totally a supporter of it because I know that my cities use it. I see the $15 million that we've allotted for this. How many cities are using this concept of embedded in the social worker program? Is this enough? I mean, this is going to be probably a long-term thing. And the thing we're not seeing that I was actually able to look into is that we're not seeing these patients anymore being transported by ambulance. We're seeing the intervention of this social worker and the police, and they're taking care of them in their home. It's the best place to get care. And so I'm real, real happy about this, and it's great that our law enforcement partners have stepped forward with this. So can you kind of give me a quick synopsis on this?
Yep, and it was not my intent to bring testifiers back up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But you were so quick, Chief, that we'll go ahead and allow this. Please keep your testimony brief.
All right. Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep it brief that these programs are growing quickly. If you look at, for example, Hennepin County, 4 years ago, there was probably only a couple cities. Now it's probably over half of the cities in Hennepin County have agreements to have embedded social workers. I think Ramsey County is growing quickly as well. It's not as quick in greater Minnesota because those resources are more difficult to find, and the partnerships with, for example, in Hennepin County, it's with Hennepin County Health and Human Services, I think, is where those social workers come from. They are effective. What they do is when the officers go to the call or when it's the actual social worker, they're quickly able to assess, does this person currently have a caseworker? If not, let's try and connect them with the services that they need. So we end up helping the person get out of crisis by connecting them with the services that they need. So the callbacks, the additional calls to those drop considerably. Is $15 million enough, I think, was the question. I'm concerned it's not, especially when you consider it's not in the base. It takes 18 months to build a program like that, and this money will obviously sunset before that. These are very effective programs. I'm concerned that that isn't enough, but I think that's an issue the committee will have to figure out how to deal with. They are very good and very successful programs. So, and the more we can get throughout the state of Minnesota, the better we are going to be at helping people who are in crisis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, could I have Superintendent Evans come down?
I will, simply because this is part of the bill. So go ahead, Superintendent Evans, if you can come down. And go ahead and start asking your question as he's walking down, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Superintendent Evans, in the past, I worked on multi-jurisdictional violent crimes task forces as well, alongside BCA, alongside with the federal agencies as well. In your experience in the task forces, it's important. Is it important to have well-funded and strong police agencies in these communities to come alongside you to work with to make sure that they're adequately funded so that they have the resources and the personnel to be able to add to this multi-jurisdictional task force to have that force multiplier, especially in some of these communities have smaller police departments. To have that force multiplier.
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, yes, and that's what's contemplated, as I noted earlier, that as we're thinking about this, if this money were provided, we would be forming just that, multi-jurisdictional, working with our local partners. And one of the hesitations, we've had a number of agencies that are more than willing to participate and assist, but they are facing their own staffing shortages, so it's important that we would have the money to be able to fund that officer, deputy, whatever it may be, so that they can backfill behind that individual, and that's how we would look at this money.
Madam Chair, Superintendent, and I guess Representative Frazier, I mean, these are resources that you want to have the specified effect in these communities. You want to stop violent crime. You want to stop these gun crimes that are being committed against our community members. That is our goal as well in the law enforcement field. That is the goal of the Minnesota BCA and the Department of Public Safety. These resources, I think, should have some allocation or some of this portion of this increase to the BCA, increased and throw in some of these police departments to add personnel to have this force multiplier to make sure that these investigations are done thoroughly and complete and to make sure that these victims have justice brought to their families. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Novotny.
Thanks. I'll be very brief, Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. We just have some concerns. The bill has great merits. The co-responder program, I absolutely in favor of. It's done great results, but they're not a first responder program. As Representative Hewitt will say, the first question that's always asked is the scene secure? In so many situations in the metro area and even in the outstate where you're stretched out, you've got to have the officers there to respond to make sure the scene's secure for the staff to come in to start with. And the second part is we just have concerns, and based on past, we're concerned about the accountability. We watch Minneapolis's program, which I think has merits, but on a fairly regular basis, there'll be radio transmissions that these units are not available to respond, or they're very limited in their hours and responsibility and their ability to contact them when they really need them. That being said, I will encourage my members to support the bill at this time, and we just hope that you're willing to entertain further things to work with us on this.
Closing comments, Representative Frazier.
Always open to have the conversations to make things better and get the resources out there that we need, Representative Vodney. So thank you for those comments. I think the testimony says it all. We've heard from some of the community groups that do this work to help prevent and intervene with crime, but also to help heal and restore. And that's part of what we should be doing within our public safety system, because that truly does go to making our community safer. I'm proud to bring this bill to get the resources out to our communities, our local jurisdictions, and also to law enforcement to help keep our community safe. So I ask for a yes vote on this.
Thank you. Representative Frazier renews his motion that House File 25, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And Representative Frazier, you are right there in the hot seat for House File 28. We are running behind time. We do have a number of testifiers. So I'm just going to say now to our testifiers, we're going to time you at 90 seconds, but you get multiple bonus points if you can talk even faster than that. And Representative Frazier, would you like to move House File 28 to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law?
That is my motion, Chair.
All right, so the bill is now before us. I don't see any amendments. Please go ahead with your, explain the bill to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will talk quickly so we can get to the testifiers. So the cornerstone of our democracy is the right to vote. That right allows for an individual to let their voice be heard in our democracy. House File 28 will restore that right to vote back to individuals that have been convicted of a felony but are no longer incarcerated. Currently, there are approximately 50,000 Minnesotans who are living throughout our state that are on probation or parole. These are mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, sisters, brothers, and neighbors who are living in the community, working to provide for their families, paying their taxes, and contributing to our state on a daily basis. They are people that have valuable insights and have proximity to the most pressing issues in their communities throughout Minnesota. Yet, because of a conviction in their past, these same people are still denied their fundamental right to vote. We should seek responses to crime that do not simply punish, but also rehabilitate, heal, and restore. Not allowing the right to vote to those we have deemed safe to reenter the community does not further a criminal justice purpose. Restoring voting rights to those convicted of a felony crime but no longer incarcerated is one of the ways to help facilitate reintegration into the community by giving these individuals their voices to participate in the electoral process. Currently in this state, our government cannot truly be reflective and representative of all its people if certain voices continue to be shut out of the process. It is well past time to correct this, and I will yield for testimony.
Thank you. First testifier is Representative Raymond Dean. Welcome back to the Public Safety Committee.
Hey, Ray.
Please introduce yourself, although I think many of us know who you are, but please introduce yourself, begin your testimony. We are going to be timing you, so you get to be timed this time, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and committee members. As mentioned, my name is Raymond Dean, and I want to just tell you why this matters to me. One in four people in America have a criminal record, but nearly all of us have broken the law. At some point in our youth, we probably did something that if we gotten caught, guess what, we'd have a criminal record too. So my conviction actually occurred in 1976. I served 7 months. I was released from probation early and thought I had lost my right to vote forever, as many people that are convicted of felonies do. I received a pardon in 1981. House File 28, when signed into law, will allow over nearly 50,000 people in Minnesota to be able to vote. These are all people that the judicial system and Department of Corrections have deemed to be safe and not a threat to society. A majority of research shows that pro-civic behavior like voting significantly reduces likelihood of someone reoffending. This is not only an elections bill, it also is a community safety bill. This bill will positively impact community safety. Should you not be in support of this bill, I can only believe that it's because you believe that a punitive and punishment is more important than public safety. It's time for Minnesota to pass a bill. Currently, two states in D.C. allow people to vote while they're incarcerated. 21 states allow people to vote when they're released and under supervision and working and out living in public. It's time that Minnesota joins states like Indiana, Utah, and North Dakota and allow those out in public to participate in democracy and vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean.
Yes, sir.
Next up, we have Hennepin County Attorney Mary Mariotti again, and then we have Carly Stark on deck. Welcome back to the committee, and please introduce yourself yet again and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members of the committee. I am Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty, and this time I'm here to testify on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which represents all 87 county attorneys across this state. The board of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association voted unanimously to strongly support House File 28, which would restore the right to vote to the 47,000 Minnesotans who are on felony, probation, or parole. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association has also written a letter in support of this legislation, which you should find in your packets. As prosecutors, we know that people who commit crimes need to be held accountable. But those consequences should serve a purpose. We know that the purpose of probation and parole is to give people the opportunity to live in the community while also taking on the rights and obligations of citizenship. We expect them to work if they can. We would like them to have housing and pay rent, and participate in their communities in positive ways. When we deny people the right to vote, we make reintegration into the community much more difficult. Voting is the type of pro-social behavior we want to encourage of those on probation or parole because it's a sign that they are succeeding in reintegrating into the community. Research shows that allowing people to vote after incarceration can help facilitate successful reentry and reduce recidivism. So this is about public safety. I'm proud to have the opportunity to speak to you on behalf of the County Attorneys Association from around the state in support of House File 28 because restoring the voting rights of people on probation and parole is not only the right thing to do for crime prevention and public safety, but the right thing to do for our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you. Carly Stark, please come up to the table, introduce yourself, begin your testimony, and on deck we have Munira Mohammed. Welcome. Introduce yourself and begin.
Thanks. My name is Carly Stark. I am the Public Safety Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's a nonpartisan association that represents all 87 counties. I am also the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, MACAC. I represent the counties that provide approximately 3/4 of the probation supervision. I'm going to cut most of the rest of this down. We are in support of this bill. We think from the community supervision perspective that allowing probation clients to vote when in the community encourages active engagement in the community and supports pro-social activities, both of which have been shown through corrections research to increase the likelihood of success on probation. When you have people who are successful on probation, they are far less likely to commit future crimes, which protects victims long term. There are other reasons that we support it on the election side, but I will stop there. If you have questions, please let me know.
Thank you so much. And like I said, bonus points for shortening your testimony. Munira Mohammed, you are next. And on deck, we have Wintana Melikeen. Hello. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you to the chair and members. My name is Munira Mohammed, and I'm with the American Civil Liberties Union on their policy team. We're happy to speak in support of this bill. The ACLU Minnesota is a longstanding organization devoted to supporting our individual rights enshrined in our Constitution. We're here to speak in support of House File 28 regarding the restoration of civil rights, the civil right to vote. It's clear that our ability to choose our democracy is fundamental, but today we have a situation where thousands of Minnesotans who live in our communities, work, raise families, pay taxes, are barred from the most basic of civic engagement, voting. 55,000 Minnesotans have been released from prison and are still denied the right to vote. This is made even more egregious when we take into consideration Minnesota's history of and pattern of trapping individuals in decades-long probation and supervision sentences. It's an incredible travesty that finishing your sentence and becoming part of the community isn't enough to show that one has paid their due to society. In fact, the state continues to punish these people who've been to prison with massive disenfranchisement. If the goal is to truly rehabilitate people and have them become part of society again, then they need to have a voice and the ability to fully participate in civic life. The ACLU of Minnesota is supportive of House Bill 28, and we urge the committee to pass. Thank you to the chair members.
Thank you. Thank you. Also, good job. Finishing. Wintana Melikin, you're up next, and Jean LaFontaine is on deck. Welcome. Please begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Wintana, resident of St. Paul, Minnesota. I'll keep it short. I was a small business owner in 2018. I opened up a restaurant. I hired a team of staff on election day. I wanted to give them the day off to celebrate. And they actually all told me, well, we don't have the right to vote. We don't want to be off. It's not fun being at home on election day. We want to stay busy. One of them actually told me seeing the red button made him sad because he couldn't have access to it. My family has gone on to open 7 restaurants in the state of Minnesota, all the way from Rochester to businesses on the U of M campus. And a majority of our employees do not have access to voting rights because of this policy. It has made the restaurant experience not exciting on election day, even though I've been an old voting rights advocate for the last decade, working on a different series of policies. And I really just encourage folks to vote yes, particularly because we have thousands of people that are paying taxes every single day, whether that be property taxes or owning a home or sales tax, and they don't have access to their basic civil rights. And so if you believe in fair representation, I encourage you to vote yes. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Boy, these testifiers are really keeping it to the point. Thank you so much. Jean LaFontaine, up next is Jay Lindgren. Hello, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hey, everyone. Chair Mueller, members of the committee, my name is Jean LaFontaine. I'm here to express my support for HF 28. I have worked as a community organizer with the Barbershop and Black Congregation Cooperative of Isaiah and Faith in Minnesota for the last 4 years in Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. These two wonderful cities have been at the forefront of the public safety conversation in Minnesota because of the civic participation of some residents in both cities. Despite this emerging civic life, it is also the case that these cities lag when it comes to voter participation, especially in communities of color. One reason why I believe this to be the case is because of the perception that in Minnesota, upon felony conviction, one permanently forfeits their right to vote. Over the course of the past 4 years, I couldn't tell you how many people, black, brown, and white, I've met who, because of this nasty bit of misinformation, rooted in a kernel of truth, believe their right to vote to be permanently eradicated. I also can't tell you how many people I've met who serve their time, are productive members of society, and wish more than anything that they could vote, but currently find themselves on the wrong end of structural disenfranchisement. As a Puerto Rican who can't vote in U.S. federal elections if I live back home in a different way, I know what it's like to be part of a class of people who are structurally disenfranchised because of an archaic, arbitrary, and oppressive system. It feels like your voice doesn't matter. It feels like you don't matter. If we expect tens of thousands of Minnesotans to reintegrate into their communities and help create and maintain community safety, we need to treat them like their voices matter. Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center would be the better for it, as would, I imagine, many other communities across the state of Minnesota. By restoring civic dignity to tens of thousands of our neighbors, HF 28 would do just that. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. The next testifier is Jay Lindgren, and we have Ann Svingenson on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and lead, and other committee members. I am Jay Lindgren. I live in St. Louis Park. I am a leader with Faith in Minnesota, and we choose us. I come before you today to support this bill. I strongly urge you to restore the vote for the convicted persons who are our neighbors. I spent 50 years working in corrections in Minnesota, in Texas, and Rhode Island. The experience taught me that individuals who commit so-called street crimes believe they have little stake in civil society. Disenfranchisement only amplifies that belief. Each of us have good habits and bad habits. I want voting to become every citizen's good habit. Bad habits in the form of addiction, drugs, alcohol, criminal acts can be difficult to break. We have known for decades that the younger someone is when they commit their first crime, the more likely they are to commit another. We also know that people who have committed many crimes are more likely to do it again than somebody who's only committed one crime. We also know that individuals who commit violent crimes, one violent crime, are much less likely to commit another crime than those who are chronic. Because of that, I would think it's wrong-headed, and I know this is floating around, to exclude individuals who have committed the most serious crimes. I want to quickly add that I am delighted by the symmetry I see between this bill and House File 110. That bill pre-registers 16 and 17-year-old youth to promote development of the good habit of voting, beginning at age 18. Two bills that promote the good habit of voting will strengthen our democracy and help reduce recidivism. Thank you for listening. I respectfully beseech you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ann Stingenson, you're up next. And then on deck, we have Jared Freeberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller and Minority Leader Novotny and all the committee members. My name is Ann Stenningson. I serve as Bishop of the Minneapolis Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a synod that spans from Bram to New Prague, from Buffalo and St. Michael's to the Mississippi River. Recently, a number of our leaders and congregations have been really interested in this question of restoring the rights to people who are no longer incarcerated. Why, might you ask, are a bunch of Lutherans engaging in this issue about voting rights? First, we believe in the dignity of all people created in God's image. We believe in the hope for restoration and reconciliation, and we are committed to follow God's call to love our neighbor as ourselves. And that active love for a neighbor often calls us into the public square to advocate when the dignity or the hope for restoration is diminished in people's lives. In 2013, our national church approved a social statement, "The Church and Criminal Justice Hear the Cries." There are many cries named in that social statement. You today, as committee members, have an opportunity to address the cries of ex-offenders seeking to re-enter fully into their communities. You can make decisions today that lead to either stigmatization or to dignified reintegration. I hope that you will pass H.F. 28. And finally, I just thank you for living out your callings in public service. It is hard work and good work and important work. Thank you.
Thank you. Jared Freeberg is our next testifier. Antonio Williams is on deck. And as you're walking up here, I'll just remind members, we do have letters in your packets and those are posted online as well. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, committee members. My name is Jared Freeberg. I live in Shakopee, Minnesota, and I serve as senior pastor of St. James Lutheran Church in Crystal, Minnesota, and today I'm speaking in favor of House File 28. As a faith leader, I believe that we should always strive to follow the command to love our neighbors as ourselves. However, as I have worked with lay leaders and Lutheran pastors across the Minneapolis Area Synod, toward restorative justice in the form of voting rights, I've continually heard stories that illustrate how our current laws fall short of this expectation and of the negative impacts of collateral sanctions in the criminal justice system, which fall disproportionately on communities of color and therefore fail to demonstrate this compassion for all people. It is my sincere hope as an active faith leader in the state of Minnesota that our criminal justice system won't continue to be a system based on punishment that falls disproportionately on communities of color, but rather one of restorative justice. And so I urge the community and the committee to approve House File 28. Thank you for having me, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Antonio Williams, and on deck is Kevin Reese. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Williams. You can go ahead and introduce yourself again and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Antonio Williams. I served 14 years and 2 weeks in the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I have been home 2.5 years. Every election cycle, I have worked on a campaign. I have worked on Mary Moriarty's campaign. I have worked on Keith Ellison's campaign. I have worked on Robin Wansley's campaign and more and more. And I have also led voter engagement, voter turnout initiatives. I have been welcomed back into community by community. but I'm not welcomed back into my community fully by my state, by my country, because I'm not fully included in our democracy. What I know about inclusion is that it restores more than just the power to choose representation. It restores dignity. It restores hope. Without full participation in our democracy, we are seeing people who say, this isn't mine, so why should I care? Why do I have an interest in being a productive member of society if I have to pay taxes but I can't choose my representation? And so what this bill does is it restores hope, it restores dignity, and it says, I have a community who recognizes my worth and my value, and that when I'm better, my community is better, and my community sees that. I urge everyone here to support this, because it is not about just voting. It is about making sure that we are full and we are whole again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Kevin Reese, and on deck we have Zeke Caligiuri. Welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you to the rest of the committee. My name is Kevin Reese, and I am founder of Until We Are All Free. Until We Are All Free is an organization that I created for justice-impacted people to have seats such as this, to have an opportunity to advocate and speak on our behalf. When I was a senior in high school, I was sentenced, as a senior in high school, I was charged and convicted of a felony in the state of Minnesota. And I was sentenced to serve 15 years, and 15 years is what I served. And each day, walking through those halls, serving my time, paying my debt, with hoping that what I could become will be based off my choices and what I had access to. My personal choice was to dedicate my life to be a community servant. And this is why I founded Until We Are All Free. But in this world, I'm limited based off not my personal choices, but what I have access to. As of now, I don't have access to my right to vote, which limits my advocacy. I ask that you all support HF 28 because it matters. And if I am going to be imposed taxes on me, I think that I should have the right to vote. And I want to ask the state of Minnesota, after paying my debt, is it too much for me to ask for my receipt? And on that receipt, can we acknowledge the impact of me not having my vote, but ask to pay taxes as a violent attempt on my humanity? So I ask you all to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Zeke Caligiuri, and on deck we have Dr. Chris Uggen. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you to the members of the community. My name is Ezekiel Caligiuri. I do community outreach work for the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I recently returned home after more than 22 years in a cell. In that time, I wrote a book, earned a college degree, and did my best to uplift those who live in the institution. I took part in several campaigns to organize family members of incarcerated people to vote. Since my return, I worked with MNJRC just this last fall to engage re-enfranchised voters to get out and vote and participate in our democracy. I have always worked hard to be better than the young person that made those irresponsible choices when he was younger. I was a part of that generation in the 90s that much of what Minnesota's criminal legal system used as its reasoning for such punishment-centric expansion. I support House File 28. But I would also like to be clear that my liberation is not bound to my ability to vote. My liberation is bound to all people who have been counted as a part of a human inventory, but not counted at a ballot box. The justice-impacted people you see in here today are people who have transformed out of a sense of their own personal determination and purpose. When you look a little closer, you'll understand that how, as a society, the growth of these systems have made us all just as impacted in some regard, even if you don't see or understand how. As a homecoming community, we recognize voting rights is only a single aspect one needs to ascend out of the human captivity business. We have to be better to recognize and grow out of the harms that we've created. But as a society, voting rights restoration show us that you want us to do those things. My liberation isn't bound to a ballot, but Minnesota's is. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Chris Uggen, and members, we'll see how many questions we have. We do have some time to go over a little bit, but we'll just see where we land here. Right, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Uggen. I'm a longtime U of M faculty member and author of a book on felon disenfranchisement. I speak in favor of the bill. Since 2016, eight states have similarly restored the right to vote for non-incarcerated people. So that means that Minnesota has slipped from kind of the middle of the pack in restrictiveness to one of the more restrictive states. Reenfranchisement would, of course, extend civil rights to about 48,000 Minnesotans in every county in the state. It's also a racial justice issue and would reduce racial disparities in ballot access, restoring the vote to about 4% of the American Indian population in the state and 4.6% of the black population. It would respond also to public opinion, which favors reenfranchisement for those on community supervision and accord with standards all over the world. It would finally support public safety and the reintegrative goals of community supervision. So both for people on probation and parole and then beyond, once they start voting, they're extremely unlikely to get in trouble again. It would also reduce confusion about eligibility and eliminate these unlawful voting charges against people who are otherwise doing just fine on supervision. And it's fair. Right now, people on probation are often disenfranchised far longer than those sentenced to prison. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We now move to members of the public. And I believe Tom Evanstad, did you indicate you were interested in, please come back to the table and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mueller, Vice Chair, Rep. Frazier, members of the committee. Nice to see you again. My name is Thomas Evanstad still, E-V-E-N-S-T-A-D, and I'm a disenfranchised Minnesotan testifying in support of this bill. In 1999, I was wrongfully convicted in Hennepin County, Minnesota. Upon release from prison, I was unable to vote and therefore unable to run for office. Being unable to vote or run for office in government to use my hard-earned knowledge and experience to try to make positive changes has been extremely demoralizing and really unfair. Disenfranchising felons on probation is a continuation of punishment that serves no rehabilitative purposes, but does serve to further alienate probationers, increasing their likelihood of reoffense. I'm the poster boy for this bill. Upon announcing my intention to run for governor at the medical cannabis hearing in 2014 when I was finally eligible, I was framed all over again and coerced into taking the deal for 20 years of probation and 100 months hanging over my head by the same people, Mike Freeman and John Choi, who recycle real criminals. And finally, this bill will give between 47,000 and, 57,000, we've heard different numbers here today, but it will give one Minnesota a voice and also prevent others from being maliciously prosecuted in order to prevent them from running for high office, like in my own case when felon voting disenfranchisement was weaponized against me to prevent me from trying to run to help make Minnesota safe again. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, we'll move to member discussion. I don't know how much discussion we have, so I will entertain it laying this over, but I just wanted to get a feel first for how much discussion that we have. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this forward. This is a discussion that is long overdue. And when I say long overdue, I'm talking the founding of the state. Mm. I have some history with this issue years ago, long before I ever contemplated representing conservative constituents in Wright County. I was an activist and on the right side of activist groups, and there was a brief moment of looking across the aisle at each other and saying, are there a few things, are there a few issues where we can see eye to eye? And this was one of them, where there was a conversation about, why is this a thing? Mm-hmm. And the thing that stuck out to me from those conversations was just the historical footnote that there's never been this conversation. There's never been a public policy, public deliberation moment where people got into a room and asked themselves the question, should we have thousands of people walking around out there who would otherwise be eligible to vote and can't? When this provision in the Constitution, or the original language, was enacted, we didn't have a probation system. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the 1800s.
Right.
If you got in trouble, you were going to jail or worse.
Right.
And that's all there was. There was no gradation of it. Since then, obviously, the system's gotten a lot more complicated. And therein lies the concern that folks on my side have, that as I listen to this testimony and I listen to the arguments, as compelling as they are, it gets to the point where we lose sight of why folks have felony status in the first place. It's not something random. It's not something that you trip into. Their actions are taken, which result in you having to serve a sentence. And probation is part of that sentence. And the whole point of a criminal sentence is to have your civil rights restricted to some degree or another. So I think the question that we have to consider here, as we're finally having this conversation, is voting on the list of things that should be restricted properly when somebody has a felony conviction? And I'll be honest with you, I struggle. I struggle very much with the answer to that question, but I'm glad that we're having the discussion, and I don't really have a question for you, but you can feel free to respond if you wish.
President Hudson, I appreciate
it.
Sorry, Madam Chair, trying to rush because of the time, but yeah, I came to you on the floor, and you mentioned that, so I appreciate you bringing it up on the record here. The conversation here in Minnesota, Representative Dean, who sat here to testify, was one of the members that used to carry this bill. Before that, it was Keith Ellison, and then it was Bobby Joe Champion. So it has been brought up in this body, and we've wrestled with whether or not we should move it forward, and it has not yet. I am hoping we are at a point where we can understand and appreciate from the testimony that we heard how impactful it would be. And we heard a testifier say it's not just about voting, but it's about feeling that we actually are, or these individuals actually are, welcomed back into the community in a whole way, not just part of the way, but bringing you back in a holistic way, saying that you belong here and we think your voice is important and we value that voice. And so you get a chance and an opportunity to decide who represents you. And for me, that is the stake, that ownership stake, right? Because I think we all do better when we have a vested interest in something. And if I can say, yeah, I voted for that person, I had an opportunity to do that, I am more vested and more engaged. And that's what I want to see. And I think we would probably all agree, giving that back to individuals as they reenter the community. But thank you for that. I appreciate it.
And I have on the list, I have Representative Becker-Finn and Representative Novotny. And so I think we'll do that and we'll move to a vote. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And, you know, wanted to share the experience that I've had in going door to door and trying to, you know, encourage people to vote. And, you know, a lot of times if they see that person at the door with the clipboard, or they see any stickers on your lapel, I've had people, I can't vote. And they're, because the system has rejected them, they don't think that they have even, that it's even worth having the conversation with you about the way that they think their community could be improved. Mm. So you end up not even having that full discussion with members of our community who are living in these houses and driving on the same streets and going to the same places. They're fully members of our community, yet this system is rejecting the idea that they are part of our community. And so I've seen that look on someone's face, and honestly, the current system is confusing, you know, because then it's like, well, are you still in paper? You know, and you're trying to figure out, and a lot of times they're not, but they thought because the system's confusing, well, I have a felony, I can't ever vote. And so that's part of this too, is streamlining it, making it more clear. If you are out here living in our community, then you should have the ability to fully participate in that community. And I just think it's important to get that on the record. And just, I also want to thank the testifiers, especially the folks who have experienced being incarcerated. I think to be honest and in public to talk about that, you know, there can be a lot of shame about that. And I think that that was the most compelling testimony. So I want to thank everyone who testified today on that, because it's really critical that we hear from them. It's the Department of Corrections. It's not the Department of Continual Punishment. We're trying to get you to a point where you are participating the way that you folks are all participating. And so thank you for sharing your stories, and thank you for the time, Chair Mueller.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and Representative Frazier. I'll probably be violating my 8-minute floor rule when this comes to the floor, because I've got a lot of areas I'd like to cover. But I am going to encourage my members to vote their conscience. I struggle, as Representative Hudson also said, struggle with this since Monday night. Well, before Monday night was hard. I did a lot of soul searching. And it occurs to me as I sit here now that the one person that hasn't had their right to restore are the people that aren't here because they've been victims of violent crime. And for that, I am going to vote no, to stand up for the victims that don't have that right. Thank you, Manager.
Thank you. And we'll move to closing comments, but I'll just note that there are letters in the packet, including from the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, that does support this bill. Closing comments, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And again, thank you to the testifiers that came here to share their stories today. You know, there is a place for accountability. We have a system that provides for that accountability. And once we have determined and concluded that those individuals can go back into the community and reenter that community to which they've come from, we want them to be successful. We should send them back in a whole way. We should restore their right to vote. There was an individual that testified in the last committee stop, was a pastor from Red Wing. And one of the comments she said, and it's going to stick with me throughout this now, she said, restored people restore communities. We want folks reentering the community to give back, pour back in, and restore the community. I hear Representative Novotny, but I believe in redemption. I believe you do as well. This is part of the redemptive process, restoring folks so they can be whole and give back to their communities and continue on in a positive way. I urge a yes vote.
Thank you. Representative Frazier renews his motion that House File 28 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right, members, thank you for your going extra today. I'm still learning as we move along, and we will try to continue to tighten things up so we can finish on time. Thank you so much. This meeting is adjourned.